Welcome, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, I know you love history. And September 7th will mark the 250th anniversary of prayer in Congress. Historical moment.
I'm intrigued.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Like many things in this country, that tradition began right here in Philadelphia during the first Continental Congress at Carpenter's Hall back in 1774. And, you know, I thought about this and I'm like, we have the rise of Christian nationalism. We have ongoing debates over the line between church and state. And so it's the perfect time, I think, for us to look back at the founding of this country, the idea of religious freedom, and examine exactly where that line between church and state should be. Lots of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court now. So our big question for today's show is, where do you draw the line between church and state? And we want to hear from you. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. We're talking prayer in schools. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, you know, having religious symbols on public property. Mm-hmm. Should you be able to wear religious garb when you go to work, if you work for a government entity? These are all questions that, you know, look at the line between church and state, but also religious freedom. People, you know, this country, the Absolutely. First Amendment protects religious freedom. So we want to hear from you, 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Can I tell you a quick story?
Tell me.
When I was doing research for this show, I was looking back at this first prayer in Congress 250 years ago, and it was offered by a local Reverend Jacob Duché. And he was the official chaplain of the First Continental Congress for like 2 years.
Wow.
Then the British came to Philadelphia and they occupied the city. And Reverend Duché was like, all right, I'm with them now.
Wow.
He went with the British.
He was a turncoat.
He was a turncoat. This guy was the Benedict Arnold of the clergy. Duché.
How are you going to do that? picked the wrong side, I guess.
Yeah. And then he had to leave to go to England. I'm serious.
Wow.
I'm serious. This is a true story. Jacob Duché.
You always find the little nugget.
And I was
a little bit. You find the nug.
And I was a little bit like, oh man, this would have been a great headlines of yore. But you know.
But you know what? You can wait a few months. Do
People
it again.
Forget.
Yeah.
Forget you ever heard that, folks. Forget you ever heard that.
Bring it back.
So we're going to do a trio of local news stories before we get into our big show topic today. And let's start with the Sixers Arena and Market. We really do need a theme song.
We do.
For like every time we talk about this, because it happens so frequently.
But it's in the it's like, it's real. It's getting realer and realer every day.
It sure is. So imagine you just heard some theme music, and we're talking about the Sixers Arena again. So yesterday, the Inquirer reported on a proposal by Comcast Spectacor to turn the Fashion District Mall, which the Sixers want to use for their arena, instead into a biomedical research facility. Now, this is notable for a couple reasons, Cherry. A, Comcast owns the Wells Fargo Center, where the Sixers play now. It does not want the Sixers to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And B, Comcast Spectacor is owned by Comcast, which has a lot of money. So, you know, theoretically, the idea of them purchasing this property and turning it into some sort of biomedical research hub is, you know, seeming kind of feasible sounding, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that came out yesterday. Also this week, an outlet called ROI New Jersey is reporting that state officials over in New Jersey, in the Garden State, are trying to convince the Sixers to build their new arena in Camden. We already knew that, but the details are becoming quite specific, including the fact that state officials in New Jersey want to offer hundreds of millions of dollars in tax incentives, yes. And when you say it like that, it sounds like even more. And they even have a proposal with a location that they're passing along to the Sixers. And the location is, there used to be a former state prison just north of the Ben Franklin Bridge in Camden near the waterfront. So that's where they say this Camden arena would be built. And the Sixers officials say they're seriously considering New Jersey's offer. Their lease is up in 2031 at the Wells Fargo Center. And they say they're running out of time.
Yeah. I mean, the up the ante. Can we say that? Up the ante
you
right
just
now?
Said it, so I think you can say it.
And, but we heard, you know, when we have council member Squilla on the show, when we had Mayor Parker, like a lot of our officials here in Philadelphia say they are committed to keeping the Sixers in Philadelphia. And so
we shall
see. We shall see what's going to happen. But
what do you think about this biomedical research hub that Comcast says it's going to build over the, where the mall is now?
I think that's interesting. I would love to see the impact studies and see what that'll do to Chinatown. And I'm throwing that out there because it's like almost anything. But that might be a better move. We don't know.
Yeah.
$400 million though, when I heard that amount, I was like, New Jersey.
Yeah.
Over here
that's
putting
a real
the sugar in there. You know?
That's a real push.
And I remember when we kept saying David Adelman, one of the co-owners of the Sixers, said there was no plan B. And then he's like, but,
That also starts with the letter B.
Exactly.
But I'll say this for the biomedical facility. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an idea. It's not fully baked from what we can see in the reporting from the Inquirer. And it's been 2 years. And this is sort of the best alternative that Comcast has come up with. I would say if I was the city, I would want a plan that really makes sure that they follow through. Because as soon as this Sixers arena proposal goes away, the city loses all of its leverage. They don't own this property.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure if you're going to say we're going with Comcast on this,
that they're going to
actually do it, right? Yeah. Because it would be pretty easy for them to say, oh, well, interest rates aren't looking so good. And, you know, we're really focused on South Philadelphia right now. So that's the warning I would offer to city officials. Their leverage is really in the next few months.
Yeah, and we will be watching it because, Squilla said 2 months. So
two
we'll
months.
See.
Clock is ticking.
A story that kind of upset me, Avi, is this string of deaths in our region caused by drivers accused of being under the influence of alcohol. And to me, it's highlighting a problem of drunk driving. On Tuesday, a woman turned herself in connection with two deaths on I-95 that took place on March 3rd. Police say she was drunk, she was speeding, and using the hands-free option on her Ford Mustang when she allegedly caused a four-vehicle crash on 95. Also, last week, police identified and charged 43-year-old Sean Higgins with driving under the influence in connection with the death of NHL star Johnny Gaudreau and his brother Matthew on Thursday. And they talked about this gentleman who is a Drexel grad. He told police that he had 5 or 6 beers before getting behind the wheel of his car. And if you recall, Avi, we talked about this on the show. 68-year-old Michael Behe, was charged in the death of cyclist Children's Hospital Philadelphia doctor Barbara Freitas on July 17th. So you have three
high profile.
Drunk driving incidents that claim multiple lives. And so this made me like look at the numbers. We've seen, you know, in 2022, there had been a 32% all traffic deaths, 32% were caused due to drunk driving. And
so about a third. Yeah.
About a third. And so this is a serious problem. I mean, cars are getting bigger. We've talked about this, all the pedestrian deaths. People are driving faster, and there's so many options. And so I just wanted to just put my legal eagle hat on and just tell people, think twice if you drink and drive. Because if you hurt someone, in addition to facing liability and losses for a grieving family, you could also face criminal charges. All of these folks are going to be charged with manslaughter or some other criminal charge in connection with that drunk driving incident. This is serious.
Yeah. And back in the 60s, when people started focusing on drunk driving as a public health problem, there were an estimated 25,000 deaths attributable to drunk driving in a given year. And through activism and changes in law, that number started to drop. It got down to 10,000, but it sort of plateaued around 10,000, 11,000, 12,000. And I think that this brings us to this point with drunk driving where we have to consider whether we've reached the limit of advocacy and awareness and whether something else needs to be done. And I just want to note that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in December opened the door to the possibility of looking at what they call passive alcohol detection devices. So these are things that would basically like not allow you to drive the car
if
it can sense that you've had too much to drink. That is the next debate here from where I stand. Are we going to put hard technology in vehicles that prevents people from driving drunk to sort of push through this 10,000 death barrier and get it down to a far lower number. Now, that brings up a whole host of other issues and concerns. But I do think, like, all the evidence suggests we've gone about as far as we can go
with advocacy. It's still happening. It's still happening. So
we'll keep the next story, I guess, for another day. Mm-hmm. Basically, a guy in Pennsylvania decided to found his own country in Antarctica. You have to Google it.
It's called
West Arctica.
Arctica.
So shout out to West Arctica. And you just have to Google West Arctica and find out what the heck we're talking about. We're going to get now to our main segment for the show today, our big topic for the show, the separation of church and state. We're also, we're seeing tons of comments already coming in on this.
Yes,
where do you draw the line between church and state? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. And as we go out, this is a little music from James Darren, the Philly native actor and singer who died on Monday at age 88.
She acts sort of teenage, just in between age, looks about 4'3". Although she's just small fry, just about so high, Gidget is the one for me. A regular tomboy, but dressed for a prom. Boy, how cute can one girl be? Although she's not king size, her finger is ring size. Gidget is the one for me.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, our big topic today is inspired by one of my favorite things, history.
Yay.
So let's set the scene. It was September 1774 here in Philadelphia, and to be more specific, Carpenter's Hall in Old City. The first Continental Congress was held, and the session opened with a prayer by Reverend Duché of Christ Church. This year, 2024, Carpenter's Hall is celebrating the 250th anniversary of prayer in Congress.
And religion and politics, while separated on paper, have always been intermingled, whether that is a prayer at a school's football game, a public school teacher wearing a cross around their neck, or the Ten Commandments displayed in classrooms. So today, we ask the question, where do you draw the line between politics and religion? And we want to hear from you. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org.
And let me introduce our guests for the hour. Here with us is David Krueger, Executive Director of the Dialogue Institute based at Temple University. David, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Rachel Lazar, who is the President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Welcome, Rachel.
Good to be here.
And finally, joining us is Judge Cheryl Allen, who is of counsel at the Pennsylvania Family Institute. Judge Allen, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
We do have a caller, but before we go to them, David, I wanted you to take us back 250 years to the founding of this nation, to the very first prayer in Congress. What was it? And walk us through that moment.
Sure. It's important to kind of establish the context of the event of the Continental Congress itself. This was a really important event in American history in the sense that this was the first time that representatives of the various colonies gathered together in one place to talk about their kind of continental identity in opposition to the British imperial rule. So this was just to get a sense of the context, this was the first time that many of them had met one another. Mm-hmm. They're all coming from very different colonies with very different assumptions about religion. Pennsylvania, of course, being a colony that was deeply committed to religious freedom and tolerance. William Penn's founding charter of privileges in this colony was a place where there was no established church. You could express your religiosity in a variety of ways as long as it conformed to this belief in one God. So there was relative freedom to practice. Many of these individuals were coming, though, from colonies where there were established churches. What that means is that in a colony like Massachusetts, it was the Congregational Church that was the official church. So you pay
like the Church of England is of England in Massachusetts. They had their state church.
Exactly. And that really was the norm in the most of the American colonies at the time, that there were established churches. It was the assumption that in order to have a moral, prosperous society, you needed to have also religious conformity around common religious assumptions. But so when these folks gathered together in Carpenter's Hall, they were coming from a variety of different settings.
Yeah.
And they began to ask these questions of, okay, how do we find common ground despite these differences? One of the representatives from Massachusetts, Thomas Cushing, I believe his name was, suggested that the convention open with a prayer of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, as the story is often told, it's like, oh, this was totally unanimous. Everybody was on board. But there was actually some debate about that. A couple of judges that participated in that event, John Rutledge and John Jay, who went on to be justices of the Supreme Court, were concerned that there was so much diversity of – they were so divided in religious sentiments that how could it be possible that you could have a prayer that could appeal to
everyone could agree on.
That everybody could agree on.
Yeah.
It's difficult to find that common ground. But in time, they realized, okay, well, we'll go ahead and we'll do this prayer. So Jacob Duché was brought in. He offered a prayer, read from Psalm 35. Mm. The prayer essentially was about kind of blessing this new revolutionary step of finding unity. What it's also kind of interesting is that I heard in the setup that you talked about how Duché later turned against the whole revolutionary cause.
Duché, it's very interesting. Duché, yeah. Duché.
Shame, shame, shame. But it's very interesting that in later some of his reports, he was essentially saying that, look, I did this in order to achieve favorable circumstances for my parish in the city, and this is why I did. But then when the British came and occupied the city during the fall of 76 to 77, that period, he turned against the
colonial. He was just looking for the best position for him and his congregation. And so, but that's what's interesting is that there was a debate from this. Even before there was a constitution, even before there really was a nation, there was a debate over this. So what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me today that what's so unique about the American experience of dealing with religion is, as I set it up, that the different colonies had different conceptions of what it meant about religion and tolerating religious diversity. The norm, as I said, one location, one colony, one nation, one religion. But now you had this diverse mix. So as the founders, you know, gathered together in the Continental Congress, as they fought together in the Revolution, it became clearer and clearer over time that this diversity needed to be addressed in a meaningful way, that you just couldn't have the assumption of there could be one prayer, one ideal that would unite everybody. So gradually between 1774 and the Constitutional Convention in 1787, we saw a shift where there was more of a shift to this recognition that the combining of religion and politics was more complicated and problematic as time goes on, and they came to a compromise.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, and what was that compromise? Because we have this First Amendment here, so I'm just wondering what the compromise was to keep it out. To keep it in, what was the compromise?
Well, in the Declaration of Independence, we see a lot of kind of God language, endowed by their creator, that type of thing. But we don't see that type of language in the Constitution itself.
Yeah.
The First Amendment is very clear that Congress shall not establish an official religion. So they came to this consensus of recognizing that, okay, we're in agreement. We're not going to have an official religion where the citizens pay taxes, but there also is going to be this protection of free exercise. So people could express their religiosity, but they were not coerced to do so. The one other interesting part of the Constitution, that what it says about religion, is Article 6. There's an interesting story about how a Jewish the Mikvah Israel Synagogue in Philadelphia sent a letter to the convention in 1787 and said, please do not require there to be a religious test for holding public office, which was the case in Pennsylvania. And the test was the New Testament, the Old Testament, or the Word of God. If you don't agree to that oath, you can't hold office. Well, who's that going to exclude? Jews, free thinkers, others. But the Constitutional Convention listened to appeals like that came from that synagogue and other arguments and recognized that they agreed that Article 6, there shall be no religious test for holding public office. Mm. So we see overall the Constitution as a document that protected, that refused to ordain, to bless one religion, but created that space for the people to freely exercise and created the diversity of anybody can hold public office today, regardless of their religious sentiments or not.
And by the way, our topic this hour, where do you draw the line between church and state? Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. David, this history is so fascinating, and I can't move on quite yet, because the big question I've always had is America a place grounded in the idea of religious pluralism, or is it a place grounded in the idea that these people who were escaping one theocracy could come here and kind of set up their own? And from what I'm hearing you say, it kind of depends on where you stop the timeline and whose perspective you're looking through in those, you know, formative years of the 1770s.
Yeah, I think that it has been an ongoing dialogue and conversation over the centuries about what is the proper role of religion in public life. As I said, in the 17th century, most people had the assumption of if you're going to have a moral society, you have to have the same religious ideas.
Yeah.
But the American experience is so complicated with all of this diversity. And of course, even the groups that we don't talk about, Jews and Catholics and free thinkers and Muslims who arrived on slave ships throughout the Americas. This type of diversity required a new way of imagining how to deal with religion in public life. Now, I'm not purely like a person who says, we should be a completely secular society, like a French laïcité kind of approach where you don't have religious expressions in public at all.
Right.
But I also think it's deeply problematic when there are certain movements in the U.S. today that are trying to enshrine one particular version of Christianity as the official guidance for all laws and all policies. I'm of the perspective that in a robust, diverse democratic society, we need to create venues and pathways for people to approach their public life and their political involvement through whatever ways that they wish to argue for their policies, whether it's from secular philosophical perspectives or a variety of religious perspectives. Mm. And lastly, I think it's important to recognize that there is no one religious perspective on any issue. Religious people, even within the same denomination, are exceedingly diverse in how they view politics.
And that was going to be my question to you, because this country was majority Christian. It still is majority Christian, although the number of people who are non-believers or don't identify as religious is growing. Can you talk about how that has shifted and how has Christianity been sort of by default kind of baked in?
I think that is. And I'm not saying argument that's a terrible thing, because there are wonderful ethics and values in the Christian tradition that certainly have informed certain laws and certain things in American society today. But yes, as time goes on, the nation is becoming more diverse and we need to be much more broadly inclusive. And I would argue, as a person committed to religious diversity and democracy, more hospitable to a variety of perspectives. I think the essence of a democratic society is that there is space for people to approach their public life and through whatever lens they wish. And when 24% now of Americans are religiously unaffiliated, that is also a group that needs to be included. Be uplifted and given space next to Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and the myriad other traditions represented in the nation today.
All right. So now let's bring it up to the present and let's bring in a caller. Mm-hmm. This is Victoria from Princeton, who is a retired public school teacher and wants to weigh in on today's topic. Victoria, you're on Studio 2. What would you like to add to the show today?
Hi. It's a wonderful show, and I love the fact that you're giving it a historical context. I taught in the public schools in three different states for many years. I taught mostly English, and I'll have to tell you, it would have been nice to be able to teach the Bible because it was such an important reference for so many of the literature that I taught. But on the other hand, I would have been appalled if I had to exercise a religious practice like prayer, because that's a practice, not an intellectual context. So I draw the line at being a scholar and a practitioner of a religion. And I also just want to throw out, can you talk about the Jefferson Bible for a second?
The Jefferson Bible.
The Jefferson Bible.
Well, first of all, Victoria, thank you for that comment. David, anything on the Jefferson Bible? That was just thrown in there. Well, but
quickly, I mean, Jefferson was very much committed to a sense of he was not really a theist, a Christian theist in a traditional sense, but he definitely believed in the morality. He understood himself to be a follower of the way of Jesus, so to speak, according to his ethical principles. So he essentially created a version of the Bible where he removed the miraculous, the miracles from the text, focusing on ethics practices.
That's interesting. Well, I'm glad Victoria had us address that. All right. So maybe that's a great opportunity
to transition to
where we are today. Mm-hmm. So let me start with Rachel Lazar, who is the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And Rachel, what is the legal state of play as you see it?
Well, the legal state of play is not great. And I will take your question, Avi, to be what is the legal state of play when it comes to prayer in government proceedings? Yes.
Sure. Yeah, let's start there.
That aspect. Yeah. So basically, the court in a case that my organization unfortunately lost found based on a history and tradition type of analysis that there has always been prayer. And so in so many words, there can still be prayer in official proceedings. And the court did put some limitations, you know, on that to say that the prayer has to be inclusive and things of that nature. But they left the state of play such that legislative bodies and even local governmental proceedings can include prayer. So that's the basics of the state of play.
And where do you think it should be? Like, what is your argument about where the line should be between church and state?
So the line between church of state in government official proceedings should mean that there isn't prayer in official government proceedings. That protects all taxpayers' religious freedom. And I want to speak to that more specifically. It also protects religion from government interference. Because think about it. You can imagine that the government might say, we want to see a copy of whatever prayer you plan to give for the invocation, you know, on Monday. So make sure you show it to us. And, oh, well, you know, we don't want it to sound exclusive. Like, you know, we don't want that line about not everybody can go to heaven. So can you edit that? Right. And that's just one of a million examples of the dangers of allowing the government to really sully religion by having religion integrate into the government. But I want to speak also to my point about taxpayers' religious freedom and the need not to have prayer in government proceedings. You know, I think David referenced, and I loved your conversation, by the way, David, that even back at the First Continental Congress, there was some objection to inserting prayer into the official proceedings. And that was based on the idea that there were different types of Christians, you know, which is a really valid idea. But today, right, that problem is even more exacerbated because our current Congress now includes Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Unitarian Universalists, humanists, and others, including an array of Christian denominations. And by the way, I, as an American, am celebrating that.
Yeah.
Right? That's cool. That's part of who we are, and it's a defining feature. And that doesn't even touch on the religious diversity of the Americans who are represented by those members of Congress and who are observing and attending these proceedings. I'll say one more point on this, which is it gets even worse from a religious freedom vantage point when you're talking about a small or very local proceeding. Let's say there's some kind of a governmental meeting about a liquor license. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you show up and you don't share the religion of the person who's giving an invocation and it feels exclusionary to you, so you have the option of either participating and really violating your own religious or non-religious beliefs, or being like the renegade in your community, or outing yourself, right, as being different, which can be really uncomfortable. still in certain communities. And that's not a great position.
Thank you so much. That was Rachel Lazar, President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. If you just tuned in, we're talking about the line between church and state. Where do you draw the line between politics and religion? That's our question to you today. We want to hear from you. Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We want to bring in Lori from Collegeville, who kind of agrees with Rachel there. Lori, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment here?
Well, my comment is I grew up in Seattle, Washington, as did my husband. And there was no religion in school at all. It was not anywhere evident. We did go to church. We went to a Methodist church. But then after several moves, we moved here to Pennsylvania, and somebody from the church we were attending at the time asked me, did humans and dinosaurs coexist? And I was absolutely dumbfounded that anybody would ask me that. And then I find out that religion is very much in the public schools here, and it just blew me away. And I don't agree with it. I don't think there should be prayer at public meetings. I don't think there should be any reference to God in the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't want it in schools. I don't want it in business. I don't want it in politics. All
well, right. That is Lori from Collegeville's take. And now I want to bring in Judge Cheryl Allen, who is of counsel at the Pennsylvania Family Institute and brings a very different perspective to this conversation. So, Judge Allen, you've been listening. Where do you think prayer belongs in public meetings and in public schools?
Well, first of all, I wanted to stress the fact that when you look at our United States Constitution, specifically the first half of Article 1, Section 2, Clause 5, gives the authority to the Congress to elect a chaplain. And this chaplain, specifically over the United States House of Representatives, is the officer responsible for beginning each day's proceeding with a prayer. And so in addition to the House of Representatives choosing their speaker and other officers, they also have the right to choose a chaplain, and that chaplain is authorized to begin each day with each session with prayer. And so that is part of our Constitution. Also, the First Amendment protects the right of freedom, free speech, and free speech or private speech includes religious speech, which should be protected. Religious speech is not second-class speech. And so specifically, our organization, the Pennsylvania Family Institute, through its Independence Law Center, wrote an amicus brief in the case of can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. There you are.
Okay. In the case of Joseph A. Kennedy versus the Bremerton School District, and this is a case where, as you may recall, Coach Kennedy, after each game, specifically after each victory, he would take a knee at the 50-yard line and say a prayer. Some students were free to join him or to not join him. Some did, some did not. No one was coerced to participate. And as a result of this action and his refusal to cease this action, even though some of his prayers were silent, he was ultimately fired, and the suit ensued, which ended up before the United States Supreme Court.
Ruled in his favor. Yeah. And so is that for you where the line is, this idea that if you could pray as long as you are not compelling others to participate or you're not saying it out loud? I mean, where do you sort of draw that line?
Well, I draw the line, you know, as long as, and this is what the court held, as long as others are not coerced into praying. And the court specifically stated that with regard to the First Amendment, religious speech is protected just as other speech is protected. And with regard to the Establishment Clause. Basically, as a society, we are to take a neutral position. In other words, the government is not mandated to eliminate prayer, nor is it mandated to promote prayer. And I think sometimes people tend to conflate coercion with neutrality. You know, that if you see someone doing something or hear someone exercising their right to freedom of speech, that somehow that coerces other people to participate or it offends other people. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be honest and clear about this. Mm-hmm. People are not just offended at the idea of religion. They are specifically offended about a certain religion or a certain tradition.
Right.
And that is the tradition that Coach Kennedy was exercising. Well,
we are about to go to break, Judge Allen, and we will continue this conversation on the other side of the break. Let me read this comment from M in Pennsylvania, who says, it's fine if people pray in Congress as long as all the religions of the U.S. population are represented. That's what M thinks. What do you think? Email us, studio2@whyy.org. We will be back with much more on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back into Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the separation of church and state, or the lack thereof. So let me reintroduce our guest today. We have David Krueger, Executive Director of the Dialogue Institute based at Temple University. We also have Rachel Lazar, President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And we also have Judge Cheryl Allen of Counsel at the Pennsylvania Family Institute.
And our question this hour, where do we draw the line between government and religion? What do you think? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Or email studio2@whyy.org. And Rachel Lazar, let me give you a chance to respond to what we heard Judge Allen talk about in that prior segment. So there was this case, a major case involving a football coach who was praying at the 50-yard line, I believe after the games, if I have that right. And the Supreme Court said that was legal. That complied with the First Amendment. What's your take on that decision and sort of what it opens up moving forward?
Yeah, thanks, Avi. And I have a take because my organization, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, represented the Bremerton School District in front of the Supreme Court. So the thing about that case is the Supreme Court, with its ultra-conservative majority, was so hungry to side with the coach that they bought into what the lower court called, and I'm quoting, a deceitful narrative.
And that about was what actually happened here.
Exactly, okay. About what actually happened. And that narrative goes that Coach Kennedy was actually praying to himself and quietly, silently, right? And I just want to clarify that the school district gave him many opportunities to pray to himself and quietly in a way that wouldn't create any pressure for students to feel like they had to pray to play. Mm-hmm. Right. But he didn't take them up on it. And so the reason that so the court found this way to twist the facts, right, to find in favor of this praying football coach at a public school without really adjusting the law, because the law still says, sure, any teacher or coach can pray to themselves and silently. And by the way, kids can pray, too. Right. I mean, I think, you know, the line goes, there's been prayer in public schools ever since the first math test. Right? And that's
Lord,
true.
Give me
and
an
that's
A.
Great.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lord, help me now. And so, you know, and we don't oppose that in any way, shape or form. Here, the problem with the Kennedy v. Bremerton situation was that in reality, Coach Kennedy was praying right at that moment at a football game when coaches give the motivational speech at the 50-yard line right after the game, when all of the players surround the coach. And actually, that's why, in a completely unusual move, Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, inserted a picture of the coach with the football helmet held high in the air verbally praying surrounded by all these players taking a knee.
Let me ask you, though. So if there is this fundamental disagreement about what was actually happening at these football games with this one coach, what does it change moving forward? Because I think there's this sense that the line, wherever the line was, is shifting in the direction of sort of being more inclusive of prayer and religiosity in government spaces, in public spaces. So in your opinion, Rachel Lazar, is the line actually moving if this case is really just about a dispute over facts?
So with regard to prayer in public schools, no, not officially. The line didn't move. And you can go to our website at AmericansUnitedAU.org, and we have all these Know Your Rights guides for students, teachers, and parents in public schools. And we didn't really have to edit those guides after this case, right? Okay. Because it bought into this fiction. And I think it's also important to point out how crucial it is to separate religion from public schools in order not to create in-groups and out-groups for our children in public schools who are impressionable, who are basically captive audiences. They have to report to school and who are vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. So the justices have always bent over backwards to protect religious freedom, in particular in the public school context. But it is true, right, that this Town of Greece case that we argued back in 2014 came out, we would argue, the wrong way, you know, and did say that because, you know, there's been this history and tradition of prayer, it's okay for state bodies to continue to have prayer. Now, I would just like to point out that this history and tradition test that the Supreme Court has been embracing in this and other contexts is incredibly dangerous. I mean, what about the history and tradition of slavery not being outlawed in this country until 1865, or the fact that women in this country didn't have the right to vote until 1920?
You're saying just because it existed during the founding doesn't mean we should necessarily exist. Uphold it. Go ahead,
and I want to read this comment from Jenny, who says, I think we should keep under God and the pledge in schools. You can recite it referring to God as you understand God to be, whatever and whoever God means to you, not just my own view of God. And so I want to bring another guest into the mix, Reverend Naomi Washington Leaphart, who is a preacher, a professor, and writer. She served as the director for faith-based and interfaith affairs for the city of Philadelphia. Reverend Naomi, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Sherry. Good to be here.
Yes, and you've been listening to this conversation, and you're a member of clergy, you're a scholar, you held space in government. What do you think should be the role of faith and religion in government?
Well, thank you for the question. I think that faith and religion should certainly be in relationship. It's impossible, I think, to strip individuals of whatever their moral compass or individual spirituality is, even as they serve in government. I certainly did not give up my clergy credentials once I started working for the city of Philadelphia. But I think that the relationship has to be at arm's length, right? That the state can never become an instrument for religion, and religion shouldn't be used as a cloak to mask certain kinds of political goals, as has been said already on the call. So I think the relationship has to be sort of mindful. We have to recognize that part of what makes this country what it is its religious diversity. And religion can't be used as a tool to further state goals.
And so I got to ask you, you were the director of the mayor's office on faith-based and interfaith affairs. It was created under Mayor Jim Kenney, giving faith communities a voice in city government. What was that what was the purpose of that office, and how did it sort of bring faith into city government? Describe what it did and accomplished.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one way that faith and government can be in relationship is that people of faith, people of conscience can bring a kind of moral clarity, a prophetic voice to government to make sure that government is operating in a humane way according to our deepest and highest values. And so, you know, we put together a commission for faith-based and interfaith affairs where leaders from around the city could, first of all, know what was going on inside of government and then provide a voice of moral clarity. You know, I was serving in that role when we had the shooting death of Walter Wallace Jr. here in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and our commission wrote an op-ed that was published in the Inquirer, encouraging the city to do what was right by all of the people who are vulnerable to these kinds of acts of state violence. And so that's one way to be in relationship, holding the city, holding the municipality, the state, the nation accountable to our highest values.
Go ahead.
Well, the only other thing I'd say is that there needs to be open pathways so that people of faith can understand what's going on in government, because they still exercise authority and leadership in local communities. As faith leaders know what's going on in government, so do our people.
Yeah. And my last question for you, Reverend Naomi, is this: when it comes to religion and government, where is the line that you feel should not be crossed?
Well, the line I hold for myself is that the expression of my faith begins and ends with my body. The minute I try to impose my religious understanding on someone else and someone else's body, then I violated that person's civil rights and that person's moral conscience. So that's the line for me. Whatever my faith guides me to do, that directive is for me and me alone. And I can be happy about that. I can share with you about that, the grounding in faith that I have. But I cannot impose my moral understanding onto another person.
Thank you so much for your time. That is, I lost my place. Reverend Naomi, help me out, Cheryl.
Yes, Reverend Naomi Washington Lee Park, preacher, professor, and writer who served as the director for faith-based and interfaith affairs for the city of Philadelphia.
All right, now let's bring in another caller. This is Kathy from Marlton, who's on line one. Kathy's an atheist and wants to chime in. Kathy, what's your question or comment?
Well, my comment would be, as an atheist from all my life, I'm 60 years old, we are treated badly in this country, and I've been harassed constantly, but, you know, people knocking on my doors, trying to push religion on me. And I'm very polite to them. I say, no, thank you. I'm an atheist. And they, instead of saying, thank you, have a nice day, they feel that it's their mission or something to convert me. And I get very angry.
Mm-hmm.
That's just me personally. But right. I just, in schools, I feel if we should be like France.
Right, which was a model brought up earlier.
Why do religions mm-hmm. get tax-free status? Why doesn't a church have to pay taxes? Now that's government, that's state and religion there. That shouldn't be, I don't get that.
Okay, well, That's Kathy from Marlton. Thanks so much. And I will point out that according to Pew, in 1972, about 5% of Americans were religiously unaffiliated. And as of last check, That's up to 30%. So that we've heard from a lot of folks who are non-believers, atheists, agnostics, however they define it. And I want to bring back into the conversation Judge Cheryl Allen of counsel at the Pennsylvania Family Institute. You know, as the percentage of Americans who are non-believers increases, how should our understanding of the founder's intent change?
Well, the founder's intent, and I would say that it's, I think their intent is pretty consistent with what Pastor Naomi stated, that no one should have the right to impose their religious beliefs on another person. And that's also consistent with what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court used the word coercion instead of imposing. But the fact that someone speaks freely about their religious beliefs is not necessarily coercion or imposing their views. And I also want to state that with regard to the Kennedy case, there's no evidence whatsoever that any of those young people were coerced or forced to participate in these prayers. There's, you know, when you look at Justice Sotomayor's dissent, she expressed concern that a child might feel compelled to pray in order to play, but there is no evidence of that whatsoever. You know, we saw the coach taking a knee at the 50-yard line. I might add that athletes have been taking a knee in recent years. for all kinds of reasons, including police violence.
Yeah.
And people have been expressing, even in classrooms, their political views or their values mm-hmm. in front of children without anyone having anything to say about that or without yeah. any protesting. And so, again, Coach Kennedy's First Amendment right to private speech, including religious speech, as the court held, should be protected.
Yep.
That religious speech is not second-class speech. And as long as no one is being coerced to participate in yeah. his prayers, he has a First Amendment right to express those prayers.
Thank you, Judge. And we're wrapping up right now. And so I got to bring the conversation back to you, David. And, you know, we have a political race coming up. Both candidates have sort of said God in their speeches. They refer God bless America. We hear it all the time. Where do you see this going, this conversation going? And you have about 40 seconds. This conversation about religion and government going.
Yeah. I mean, when politicians use the term, you know, President Biden says, God bless our troops, or other politicians will say that type of language, it necessarily may not be referring in their mind to one particular tradition. It's this kind of a broad sense of a civil religion is a term that we haven't really brought up. But there's a long tradition in American history of this notion of there's this kind of vague sense of God's purpose for all of us that transcends everything. That may be exclusive to others. I do remember President Obama in his inaugural address, where he specifically, for the first time, I think, acknowledged that we're a nation of Christians, Jews, Muslims, and non-believers.
Yeah. Yeah. So, by the way, if you want to hear more on this topic, mm-hmm. you haven't had your fill yet, you can join David at Carpenter's Hall for a discussion with 9 faith leaders tomorrow, Thursday at 5:30. The tickets are available. And then on Saturday, September 7th at 11 a.m., you can witness a public reading of the first congressional prayer at Carpenter's Hall. It's all coming up this week. David Krueger, thanks so much for your time today. Also want to thank Rachel Lazar, President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and Judge Cheryl Allen of Counsel at the Pennsylvania Family Institute. We do appreciate all of your time.
Yes, and that's it for today's edition of Studio 2. Thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Mary Bessler, Andreas Copes. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Al Banks engineered today's show. I'm Cherry Gregg from Studio 2, WHYY in Philly.
I'm Avi. Thanks for joining us.